I want to introduce our presenter for this afternoon, Dr. Nicole McKee-Plunk. Nikki is an assistant professor, also from the Department of Family and Community Medicine, same department as Dr. Vinson, so you may see a little bit of a pattern here. But all of you, not all of you, many of you, work in primary care settings, and that's what Nikki and Dan do as well. So just a bit of context for this afternoon's talk. One of the things that I heard a lot from those of you working, especially in the federally qualified health centers, is that you really don't have enough time to do all the things that you're supposed to do. Many of you come from more traditional mental health backgrounds. The role of a behavioral health consultant or a health coach is relatively new, so you're pioneers in that area. And it's not exactly clear how you do this, how you fit what you do into busy, very busy primary care settings. Nikki does a lot of what you do, and she teaches other people how to do it. She does behavioral interventions with patients in primary care. And so her credibility is really strong in this area. So I just thought that a presentation on this topic might really help you figure out how to do this kind of very challenging work in a very difficult environment of a primary care clinic. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Cromer.
All right, so if at any point you can't hear me or I sort of get tired of doing this, maybe I don't really need to do that, but if you can't hear me, please just let me know. So as Bruce said, I work in a family practice department, and part of what I do is teach resident physicians how to do this. So I'm really excited to be talking with all of you today. How many of you have heard of motivational interviewing? And I suspect all of you do it. Right, so the way that I've structured things today is I have a whole bunch of slides, so I've come with things that I think will be helpful to talk about, but I find that this kind of work works a lot better when we can be more interactive. So I would really like it to be that way. We could lapse into me sort of talking at you for 3 hours post-lunch, see how that goes. But if as I'm going along there are things that you have questions about, want to talk further about, then I would be more than happy to do that. I think that's what's most helpful. So I have what I think will be helpful, but you know what really is going to be helpful. So stop me at any time. And if you do, I'm going to come at you with the microphone so that we can all hear what you have to say. Fair enough? All right. So we're going to start with just a brief review of MI basics, and I'm going to have a tendency to kind of whip through this a little quickly because I think probably a lot of it is review, but I think we can stand with a little review as well. And then how do you move forward with these skills in a primary care setting? And then we're going to do some role-playing, or as we like to say, behavioral rehearsal, because our residents hate role-playing, but I have to not call it that, okay? All right. So if you think about your clients or your patients, how do we tend to think about people? People have in their mind concepts of good clients or good patients, motivated ones. You think about who those are? Do you have any of those? Occasionally? Yep. Right? So what we have is myth, that there are those who are unmotivated. And I'm calling that a myth because we think of these people as bad, these bad clients or these difficult or challenging clients. Sorry. And I don't think there such a thing exists, right? So when you think about ambivalence, think about any sort of difficult behavior that you've struggled with, whether that's eating, exercising, getting organized, and so on. We all have something that we'd like to work on that we're not working on for whatever reason. And I would not say that we are unmotivated. Rather, I would say that we are ambivalent. So really one of the first keys to doing effective and brief motivational interviewing is all about how we approach our patients. Having empathy for them. Remembering something that we struggle with, having empathy for that. Okay? So, what helps people to change behaviors? What kinds of things are you working with patients on? Go ahead and shout out behaviors that people come to you for, or you get sent to you for.
Weight management.
Smoking.
Addictions.
Sleep hygiene.
Diet adherence.
Medication adherence.
Right? Behaviors. What causes change in people? Think about something you've tried to change. What's helped you change?
Support.
Pain.
The pain was so great you had to make a change.
Having a plan.
Relational problems.
When the costs become too high, that helps us change sometimes. Sometimes having support, visualizing a goal, those are all good things. What doesn't tend to help is this idea of a confrontational style. So this is something I talk about over and over and over again with some of our residents, which is that confronting someone and telling them all the ways in which their behavior is bad and they need to change often doesn't result in change. What happens when people tell you what to do? Right? I don't like it. So one of my favorite examples is when my husband says to me, I really probably don't need that other piece of cheesecake. I'm eating that cheesecake. And then some, probably, right? It's not enough to know that it's a problem many times. How many smokers have you ever met that don't know that it's bad for the health? I've met exactly zero. And yet, they smoke. Because they're crazy? Because they don't know? Because they're stupid? No, absolutely not, right? There are lots of good reasons why we engage in different behaviors. So providing information is often not enough to cause people to change. Or the idea that we can just provide more education, which tends to be our go-to response, I think, particularly in a healthcare setting. No, let me give you more information. Let me really help you understand the ways in which this is bad for you. Doesn't result in change oftentimes. When you can connect behavior to things that people value, that's important. People talked about relationship problems. If I can see how this is affecting important relationships, I'm more likely to consider changing. Okay? It's important to understand that ambivalence is typical. We are all ambivalent about something, multiple things. When we can explore that ambivalence, that's what increases the likelihood of change. So everybody, I think, knows what ambivalence is. What I think is important, particularly in a healthcare setting, is really approach. How do you do MI quickly? How do you do anything quickly in a healthcare setting? Think that if you take away anything, it is to slow down. Okay? Sounds ridiculous, maybe, right? The idea of slowing down in a busy clinic setting. But what I mean is understanding that change is a process, ambivalence takes time to work through. You have to understand that. You can't push and force people into change. It's normal and it's common. Okay? People know what the four guiding principles of MI are, the rule of MI is, what the R is. Rolling with resistance, that's part of it.
Riding reflex.
How about I just throw it out there for you, right? This is what we have to do. We have to resist the riding reflex. We have to understand our patients' motivations, listen with empathy, and empower them. We all have that riding reflex. That's why we do what we do. We want to fix things. We want to help people make change. We have to resist that when we're talking about somebody who has ambivalence. How do people come to see you? How do they get into a room with you? How does that come to be?
A referral
from? From their provider?
Court.
From themselves
sometimes?
A hospital.
Oftentimes, somebody's telling them or pressuring them in some way to come and see you, right? Would we expect there to be ambivalence in that situation? Of course, right? We have to resist the impulse to push.
Okay, we have to understand where they're coming from. How do they see this? What do they think about being in the room with you? Ever encountered somebody who was not so excited to be talking with you? Right? Understanding what that's about, right? What's important to them? They need to voice those things. We don't need to impose those on them or rely on a provider's word or a court's word about what those motivations are. Listening with empathy, I think we're all probably very good with about this. Using reflective listening. And then empowering people to think that they can make changes and understanding where that happens. A big part of motivational interviewing is understanding the role of the relationship. That's where change occurs, according to an MI perspective. If we can develop a relationship that is helpful, and that doesn't have to be a long-term relationship. A relationship can happen in a short or brief encounter, one or two encounters even one encounter. But change can be facilitated in the context of that interaction. That's important. That's really powerful, I think, to stop and think about. Even a brief encounter between two individuals can provide the context in which change increases in likelihood. Okay? Developing discrepancy. Discrepancy between current behavior and things that are valued. How does your smoking relate to your desire to be a good parent? Is there discrepancy? How do you figure that out as a patient? Right? Eliciting change talk. Change talk is all of these things, recognizing the disadvantages of the way that things are, or advantages of how things might be better if they changed. Being optimistic that change could happen, or having an intention to make a change. Of course, the spirit of MI is that it's collaborative. This often runs counter to the way that, in my experience anyway, healthcare settings run, right? Have you ever been to the doctor and felt like it was a partnership, that what you had to say was as important, if not more important, than what the provider was saying? Does it happen a lot? Sometimes ever, right? It's not the way the system is often set up. There's a provider who has a lot of information, will ask a lot of questions, and then will deliver an intervention. But MI is not that way. It's collaborative. What I know is important, but it's only as important as what you know, maybe even less. So it's important that we approach in that way. Eliciting motivation from the patient, not imposing it upon them. You need to quit smoking because it's causing all these other problems. Rather, why might you want to quit smoking? Okay. And so important, and also I think a little bit counter to the way that our health system works, is honoring patient's autonomy. Remembering at the end of the day, our patients are free to choose not to do anything that we want them to do. And being okay with that. This is where I lose my residence about half the time. Okay? There's this sense, I think, that we have, that writing reflects that, I have to get these people to change. I have to get them to see how things could be better. In fact, that's why they were sent to me by the provider. Because that couldn't happen in that context, now it's really my job to help make this happen. But it's not our job to make that happen. So just sort of sit with that for a second. I think that's important. It's not our job to make anybody do anything. What is our job?
Support them if they decide to.
Support them if they decide to. What else?
Encourage.
Educate.
Give them the tools so that they can.
Give them the tools to decide. All of those things are our job. Help facilitate change in the sense of increasing the likelihood, but honoring people's decision to do what they're going to do. And that's okay. Okay. We want to express empathy, develop discrepancy, as we've talked about, roll with resistance, which is one of my very favorite parts of motivational interviewing, supporting self-efficacy, right? Basic tools of MI. Everybody know what the ORs are? What's the O, anybody?
Open
questions. The A? Stuart Smalley, for those of you that remember. Affirmations. R? Reflections. S? Summaries. Excellent. Using your ORs. Fantastic. This is the way that we do the things that we've talked about so far. with things that we don't want to do. And again, I think things that the system really tends to support and enforce, the question-answer trap, right? If I just keep asking enough questions, I'm going to get enough information from you to formulate the proper intervention. Who does all the work in that scenario?
You.
Me. And according to MI, who should not be doing all the work?
Me.
Me. Right. So that's kind of cool if you stop and think about it. Our job is to do less than half the work. Right? It's a pretty good job, I think. We're doing it right. We don't want to take sides. And then by that we mean sort of, this is good, that is bad. We can provide education on consequences, but when we fall really heavily on the side of change, and if we think of ambivalence as working this way, if I push heavily for change, where does that leave the patient to go? The other side, right? So ironically, the more we push an ambivalent person to make a change, likely, the more we decrease the chances that's going to happen.
Okay.
What about asking permission? What in the world does that mean? Asking permission. When would we or why would we ask permission of patients to talk about their health behaviors? Why would we do that?
Respecting privacy and autonomy.
Respecting their privacy and their autonomy. Right? That's important because it communicates something. It communicates that respect. And when I communicate respect to you, does that increase or decrease the likelihood that we're in a collaborative relationship? Increases, right? And if this is a collaborative relationship, there's some sense that you have a responsibility to be part of this process too. I'm not going to talk at you. I'm not going to dictate what it is that we're talking about today. We're going to do this together. That's important. Small thing, takes but a second, can have a really big impact. Costs us nothing. Reflective listening. We even need to talk about this. Everybody knows what reflective listening is? It's a statement. I think that's the most important thing. Statement. It's a hypothesis testing. You're saying this to me. You're feeling this way. This is the unspoken piece of what you're telling me. Putting those things out there. Why is that important? What does it matter if we ask questions or make a statement? Why do you think it matters? Or do you think it doesn't matter? What are your thoughts?
Let your patient know you're listening.
Let them know that we're listening. Has anybody ever had somebody listen to them reflectively? Can you recall an instance when that happened? What did that feel like, those of you that are nodding?
More connected.
Feels more connected? Okay. I kind of like it when people can tell me that they get what I'm saying versus, is this what you mean? So you're saying this? That feels like you're not really getting me so much. But when you can tell me back what I'm feeling and what I'm thinking, I feel like you get it. And if you get it, you're somebody I want to talk to more. If you don't get it and you're not listening, I don't really want to talk to you about this anymore, right? It's important. It's a small thing potentially, but again, that can have a big payout. Okay. When we reflect, it puts the ball back in the patient's court. They have to keep talking. They have to come up with the next thing. That's what we want. We want them to do the work of sorting through this stuff with our guidance. How does this work for you all? How do you find reflective listening to go in a busy clinic setting? What proportion of the time do you think you do this?
It actually makes things go faster.
Do you think so?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Other folks feel that way or feel differently? I myself found initially it slowed things down immensely. It was extraordinarily difficult to do. I would catch myself asking questions all the time. Very frustrating. But the more I practiced, the better I got at it, the more natural it felt. I find it's incredibly efficient. And to this day, I find when I'm frustrated in a session with a patient, if I stop and think about it, I've been asking a ton of questions. I'm kind of exhausted. I'm not really sure where we're going or where we're supposed to be going. And when I stop that and start reflecting, I feel better. I feel more relaxed. We get more productive. We get more efficient. So I find that to be true. So I think it's important that we all kind of stop and pay attention to our skill level there and see what difference it makes. let's just practice that for a second, okay? I want you to group up in pairs, in groups of three, two or three, kind of whoever's close to you. One of you is going to be a speaker, the other are going to be listeners, okay? We're just going to take just a few minutes to do this. Speaker's going to say, one thing I'd like to change about myself is, this is not the time to disclose a criminal behavior or anything, anything like that. Something that's real, though, that you might want to talk about. The listener is going to reflect only, all right? And keep going until the speaker feels like they've been understood and switch roles if there's time. Okay? Go. So, what did people notice about that? Those of you who were speakers, what did you notice about that process, if anything? Good, bad, or otherwise?
I thought it was good often because I heard what I was saying in a different perspective.
All right, hold on. This is the microphone portion of the session. All right.
I thought it worked pretty well. I heard what I was saying from a different perspective, a way that I wasn't seeing it before. And it was really useful, I thought.
Okay. So you get to hear things come back to you in a way that you didn't hear them before. I'm going to mark this as my exercise for the day. Check it off.
I found that I wanted to share a lot more than I started out.
Good, bad, or otherwise, right? Okay.
What else?
Oh, must be what it's like to have a talk show.
We got to change talking about three volleys.
Moved into change talk in about three rounds. Pretty cool. You guys are probably really good patients, too.
It helped me to say more, to bring more out.
Great. Anything else people noticed? Okay.
I just wanted to say, it seems like then the choice becomes you can either use your attention or energy through self-exploration, or if you're not receiving that, you might be more on the defense. Either way, you would. How are you putting your energy out there? If you're not in that reflexive defense mode, and you just have this opening, then you can kind of do some more self-exploration.
Mm-hmm. So it gives you, as a listener, maybe a sense of where that energy is directed. Is this going to be defensive, not going anywhere, or is there that opening, that opportunity to say more? Here's what I think the really, really cool thing about reflective listening is. People are very uncomfortable with silence. That's our advantage, I think. So if you say something to me and I reflect it back to you, we can either sit uncomfortably in silence or you could say some more, and I think it really draws that. So if we can be resisting our impulse to fill the silence and direct and provide information and allow the space for the patient to come forward, that's a really cool thing. It's a really good thing. And I think sometimes what you find is that people say more than they intended to say. They hear things that they're saying a little bit differently. And it moves to change talk, potentially, much more quickly. Okay. The other thing that I think is really helpful about reflective listening is I stop driving the bus because I don't really know where we're going. You know, I know where I'd like us to go. But if you, the patient, can drive the bus, then I can be the instructor, right? I can say, I see where we are, right? So think about that poor driver ed instructor who sits over here in the passenger side. That's us, right? The patient is driving because really it's their life, right? We can guide. You might want to turn here. You might want to do this. But they have to do it. And reflective listening allows the space for them to do that. What was it like to be the person who was doing the reflections? The listener. What'd you notice?
It was a little bit awkward in that I wanted to ask questions or pull out more information, and I'm not as experienced in this, so I felt like I was just parroting too much. Like, I wondered if that fell off. Mm-hmm.
I think that's a very common kind of initial response is, this feels weird that I'm saying back to you the same thing that you just said to me, right? That's weird. Surely you're experiencing this as weird that I'm doing this. And yet I think often it just doesn't feel that way. It might feel different because how often does that happen? How often do you go into a healthcare setting and say something and your physician says, this is really hard for you? You know, I've got some really good doctors and I really struggle to think of one who's done that. So that's different, certainly, but different doesn't mean bad from the patient perspective. What else did people notice when they were trying to do the reflections? Other than it's kind of hard, you become aware of your tendency to want to ask. Other things people noticed? Yep.
It really makes you listen to what the patient has to say.
Yes, right? Sometimes that's a lot more effort than we like to think it is. Right? I've got a whole list in my head oftentimes of, like I said, places I want us to go. And I might be ready with my next question, but if I have to stop and reflect, then I really do have to stop and listen. And we might take another direction. And that's probably a good thing, because if that's what the patient is saying, then that's probably exactly where we need to go. Good. All right, thanks for playing along. Change talk, right? So you did not realize when you became people in these positions that you were coin purses now, right? We collect change. We collect change talk. That's what we're doing. This is how we do MI in brief settings. We really tune our antennas to hearing change talk. And there are different kinds of that. Anytime people say things about wanting, liking, wishing, that is change talk. We want more of that. Can, could, able, that is change talk. We want more of that. Reasons why things should change. Reasons why things would be better if things were if the behavior changed. That's change talk, and we want more of it. Needing. I need to do this. I have to do this. Even if I don't want to, I know that I should, or I ought to, or I must, or other people think that I should. That is all change talk. That's all important. That is not the same thing as commitment to change, but these are the steps that lead to change. We have to listen for it. And when we hear it, what do? What did we just do?
Reflect it back.
Reflect it back in hopes that we will get more of it. You really want things to be different. You really see the need to change this behavior. The likely response is more about that. Why do we want more of that? That doesn't mean the person's going to walk out the door with a quit plan if it's smoking, or a brand new diet, or head straight to the nutritionist, or to the gym for a membership. It's important because these are the steps that lead up to it. Then comes commitment to a plan, then comes the action of the plan. We become more committed to the things that we say. That's why when we talk about making a quit plan for smokers, what do we ask them to do? Tell somebody what you're going to do. Commit to it. Make a verbal commitment. It's the same idea. Does it mean that people are going to do these things? No, but it increases likelihood. And I think one thing we need to consider is we're in the business of increasing likelihoods for folks. We can't make anybody do anything. We can increase the likelihood that it'll happen. That's what this is. Tools. How many of you use the pros and cons matrix? I love this tool. I love it. I used it twice this morning already in clinic. This is good stuff, whether you write it down on paper or you just do it in conversation. Talking about the pros and cons of things staying the way they are, and the pros and cons of making changes. So you'll notice that there's an A, B, C, and D here, and that's to indicate kind of a preferred order of events. Why would we start with the pros of status quo? What do you like about your smoking? What's going well about your drinking? Tell me about that. Tell me about Sonic. That's my problem. Maybe not your problem, but Sonic is my problem. Right? So tell me what's good about it.
Happy hour.
Happy hour. Tell me about that. Right? Half price drinks is awesome. Right? And as long as you're there, you might as well have some chili cheese tots. I mean, saying. So why do we start there? Why would it matter where we start in this whole grid? What do you think?
Resistance.
It reduces resistance. How often do you, can you imagine going to a provider and they say, tell me about smoking. What do you like about that? You know, what's good about that? Feel good? Do you like the buzz? Do you like the taste? Is there a whole social component? What's good about that? What is it like when we start there? What do you think that's like for the patient besides kind of maybe decreasing resistance?
It's non-judgmental.
It's non-judgmental. I sort of find when I start there, patients are like, nothing, I guess. You know, I know the story. I've been hammered over the head repeatedly about why this is a bad thing, that I know I can't talk about it. But remember, people don't engage in unhealthy behaviors because they're stupid or they're crazy or any of those things. We all engage in at least one unhealthy behavior. I'd like to think we're all smart and reasonable, sane people, but because there are reasons, right? Alcohol. It works. If you're anxious and you drink to the point of intoxication, you're not anxious anymore. Does that mean it's the right and good thing to do? Absolutely not. But shouldn't we at least acknowledge why people might do it? If it's there, if that reason exists, let's talk about it. How can we talk about change if we don't talk about why you do what you do?
It also creates the ambivalency.
Right. Yes, it does. It holds up that ambivalence. Remember, ambivalence is this. So let's talk about that piece of it. Okay? It's a good place to start in terms of building rapport. It's a good place to start to get people thinking about it in a non-judgmental way. Let me get this right. You're somebody I can actually talk about this stuff with. So let me think about it. I'm more likely to think about it if I feel like you're not judging me. If I feel like I'm going to get another lecture, I'm not really interested, you know? So that's important. It's why it's important to start there. So if you have a very brief encounter with someone, just starting there and doing that can start the ball rolling in someone's head. You may not have to do anything else. That can be an intervention by itself, standalone, okay? Once you've kind of started there, people are talking about what's going well, if you have the time, is there anything that you don't like about it? You know, is there anything that you don't like about, I don't know, maybe the next morning when you wake up, how you feel? Or what do you think about the price of cigarettes or the smell or how people might judge that? Or is there anything, what do you not like about it? And I've sort of offered suggestions, but I think it's best to just open in a question, right? Tell me about it. Once you've talked about what they like and don't like about the way things are going, you know, being careful about how you phrase change. Not pushing heavy on change, but have you ever thought about it, or if people talk to you about it, how do you imagine that might be? What gets in the way of that? What might you not like? And then ending up with what might you like, and why is it important to end there? Kind of gives you that recency effect, right? If that's the last thing I said, you might be thinking more about that. Okay? Well, would things be better if I stopped going to Sonic? Right?
Leads into reinforcing change talk.
You bet. It's change talk. End there. Talk more about it. Reinforce it. Great. That's an intervention. Right there. That gets people starting to explore their ambivalence. Pros and cons matrix. Huge fan. Good tool. How many of you use the ruler? It's an easy thing to do, right? 1 to 10. How important is it to you to make this change? Gives me a gauge of where we're at. If you're a 10, well, okay, then we're not really talking about increasing motivation. Now we're talking about how do we make a plan. But if you're at a 1, well, that's going to change the discussion that we have. We're going to be about increasing motivation, not making a plan. Follow-up questions. You said X. What makes you see it as that important? And the phrasing of this question, I think, is important. Why is it that number and not a lower number? And saying it in that way, I think, is important. Oftentimes our tendency is, well, why is it a 3? What are we likely to hear more about if we say it that way?
Why they don't want to change.
Yeah. Well, the reason it's only a 3 is because of all these reasons I don't want to change. But what do we want to hear more of?
Why they do want to change.
Why they do want to change. So why is it a 3 and not a 1? Explain that to me. Right? That's what we want to hear about. And then what would it take to move that up to a 6? What would have to happen? So before I started working in this department, I did a postdoctoral fellowship working on a grant to use motivational interviewing to help college students stop smoking. And so the overwhelming majority of our participants in our study, how important is it to you to quit smoking? 1, maybe, 0. How confident are you that you could change, you could quit? 10, of course I could. Highly confident, not very, you know, not highly motivated. That's a very different discussion than the folks that are at a 10 in motivation and a 0 in confidence, though the behaviors look the same. So that's important to sort of ferret this out a little bit. Easy tool, takes but a second to do. Well, it takes maybe a minute or two. Okay. So while we're eliciting change talk, this idea of discrepancy, developing discrepancy, what's important to this patient? So again, one of my favorite examples of this in my own practice was a patient I was working with around smoking. We're talking about smoking, kind of around and around, and nothing was happening. Talked about family history of heart disease, family history of lung cancer, smokers who had developed all kinds of health problems. Still, she kept smoking. So kept going around and around, like, how are you feeling? How are your physical symptoms? Still, we weren't getting anywhere. One day, comes in and says, you know, this guy I really want to date. And he doesn't like smokers, so I think I'm ready to quit. So, death, not overly motivating. But dating never went there. Because I was trying to drive the bus. I was trying to help persuade and convince and not really figuring out what was important to her. Death and illness did not feel imminent. But her dating and her social life, that's where she was. Very important to see how this stuff is discrepant from what people are interested in, not what we think they should be valuing. So, what happens when people start giving us change talk? How do you know when it's time to start moving toward change, making a plan? I don't know about your work environment, but in our clinics anyway, there's a push to get this done fast, right? Prescribe. You're at about a 3 for smoking. Let's go ahead and take some steps. Let's go ahead and try not smoking anymore, right? What's the risk there? I hear lots of grumbling, right? Not a great thing, not a great idea. Sometimes we're too quick to jump to change because we're pressured to do so in our environment. So how do you do MI effectively in a healthcare setting? You slow down in the face of pressures to speed up. Hugely important. We elaborate the change talk, right? We spit back the pros and the cons. We reflect it, we summarize it, we affirm it, we use our ors. But what about when we're not getting change talk? What does resistance look like? What kind of resistance do you encounter?
Why?
Okay. What else?
Agreement.
So you get.
It's only to the point that they can get out.
So you might get people who are quiet and don't talk. You might get people who kind of yeah, gone. What else? I've come to love resistance. I think it's so much fun.
Other people's behavior force them to do what they're doing.
It is not my fault. It is not my fault. If I could change it, I would. Other people kind of make me do it or influence it. It's out of my control. What else does resistance look like?
They say they're not ready to change.
I'm just not ready. I'm not talking about this with you today. What kind of direct? We've talked about some passive forms of resistance. It can be direct.
Anger.
Can get aggressive even. You know? Absolutely. Those are all forms of resistance. How much fun is that? I kind of think it's fun now. I'll be honest, in the moment, it's not always that fun. But what does that do to us as providers when we get resistance? Does it make us love our jobs? Do you ever go home and think, why am I doing what I'm doing? What's the point of this? I do.
There's a difference between resistance and sustained talk. So resistance,
This is actually about the relationship with the patient versus sustained talk, which is I'm not going to quit out. You know, I really like smoking, or you know. So there is that difference.
So what she's saying is there's a difference between resistance and sustained talk, and I'm sort of lumping it all here as resistance, but there's a difference between resistance in the relationship, right? I'm not going to go where you want me to go, versus I'm really being thoughtful and talking about the reasons why I want to continue to engage in the behavior I'm engaging in. We're slightly different, and it is important to recognize the difference. A very good point. What do we do with resistance when we get it, though? What do we not do? Let's start there. What's a bad idea?
Argue.
Right? I've had this conversation a lot with residents, sometimes. Let me explain to you the reasons that you're wrong. Let me persuade you. Let me educate you in the ways that you're incorrect on this.
Take it too personally.
Take it personally, right? It doesn't really feel good when people sort of tell me, yeah, I know they sent you to talk to me, but you don't really have anything to offer me. I'm not going to go there with you. And that feels icky, kind of, right? Taking it personally and then reacting from that emotion. Yeah. All things we don't want to do, but things we sometimes do. And this morning I did this, and I knew I was doing it, and I just couldn't resist the impulse to explain why this was a bad choice. And so what do you think happened? My patient didn't do what I wanted them to do. They sort of became a little bit more entrenched where they were. It was not good. Fortunately, I don't think it was a really big issue, but still, it's sometimes irresistible to just explain. If I could just clarify for you, if I could say it in a way that you'll get it. Then you'll know, then you'll get it. And it's our real impulse, and I think it really speaks to the importance of being effective, is recognizing what's going on right here. Before we can do anything with what's going on in that chair, we have to be aware of what's going on in this chair. Okay. Right. When we get resistance, we can reflect it. You can reflect the words that are being said, or you can reflect the process. Seems like you're kind of wanting to agree with me. I'm not sure. Seems like maybe, though, you're really not interested in this. Is that right? Do I have that right? You know, check that out with folks. You can sort of amplify what it is that they're saying. All right. Amplify the reflection. So if they say that they're not overly interested in something, so you really have no interest in this whatsoever. Why would we do that? And maybe a little, maybe not no interest. And then what are they giving me? Change talk. I collect. It's a good thing. Double-sided reflections. Reflecting when people are ambivalent, reflecting both sides of their ambivalence. So you can see that there's value here in this discussion, but you're not ready to move on it today. Right? That's important. And then in worst case scenario, there are a number of different ways to kind of deal with this, but if things are just not going anywhere and it's moving in toward an argument, just change the subject, move away from it. It's always the best option there. But always looking for the crack in the door, right? So let's talk about that a little bit. Finding the crack in the door. So here's a statement that can be conceptualized as resistant. Yeah, I know it's risky to drink and drive, but what isn't risky, right? You take your chances crossing the street, and I want to enjoy myself while I can. Okay? Resistant? Kind of, yeah. Where's the crack in the door?
I know it's risky.
I know it's risky. So you've thought about this. So you recognize the risks here. Great. But this one. Smoking is a way of life for me. I can't imagine not smoking. I'd have to give up all my family interactions, and then where would I be? Where's the crack in that door? It's a little harder. Where would I be? Someone said giving up family interactions. Maybe that's a good thing for some of us.
Maybe that I can't imagine not smoking, and say, so you've tried to picture your life as a non-smoker before.
You've thought about this. You've given this some thought. You've given not smoking some thought. Tell me more about that. on the one hand, that's a scary thought. What else? And what are we getting? Change talk. Very good. Very good. Sometimes it's easier, sometimes it's more difficult to find it. Okay? Let's do some batting practice. It's baseball season. I want somebody to offer up a resistance statement that a client or a patient has given them at some point, and we're going to take some turns reflecting it, rolling with it. So who wants to give a resistance statement? Yes.
I've actually had a patient tell me before that my psychiatrist informed me that it would be a bad thing if I stopped smoking.
Yes. I've heard that too. I've never actually met the psychiatrist who gave that advice. So, my psychiatrist has advised me not to quit smoking.
Oh, you've talked to your psychiatrist about this.
Tell me more about that. Excellent. What else might you say?
So you've talked about it.
So you've talked about it. You want to talk about it some more. Kind of moves us into a question. Yep, good.
So you seek the advice of your medical provider when making decisions.
So you are talking with your medical providers, which you could also say is so you care about your health. It's important for you to listen to the advice of your healthcare team.
So I have a question about this whole scenario.
Yes,
then.
Perfect.
Why would they listen to you when their doctor is telling them?
Why would they listen to you when their doctor is telling them otherwise? Why might they?
So you're trying to get them to listen to themselves.
We don't really need them to listen to us. Remember, we want to be more quiet. We want them to listen to them. Again, it comes back to where we come in. Oftentimes, our natural impulse is to approach this as though it's my job to get you to change or to get you to see why it's important to change. And that is not our job. It's just not. Our job is to help our patients understand why they're doing what they're doing and why they might want to make a change and let them sort it out. We help them with that. Guide them through that. But if we want to set ourselves up as experts who are there to help them or to direct them to do things, we've already set ourselves up for failure because there's always going to be somebody who has more credibility than we do. Always. Even if you're the physician, there's always going to be somebody who has more credibility. So if we want to come in as the expert with somebody who's ambivalent about their behavior, we're not going to get very far. Which is probably, by the way, how they ended up in your office in the first place. Right? We have something different to offer here. And what we have to offer is the patient's voice. Once again, go ahead.
Your psychiatrist will probably wants you to always smoke.
Your psychiatrist always wants you to keep smoking. Amplify. Now, it's every once in a while, the risk of an amplified response is you get a kind of a wise cracking. That's right. It's hard oftentimes for folks to do that really seriously. And then if you just sort of sit with the silence, you can pick it up. Mm-hmm.
Can you respond by saying, well, what do you think of their statement?
You can respond by asking a question. What do you think about what that psychiatrist said? You can do that. I would argue that a reflection is more effective. Right? Because I suspect the answer you're going to get is, well, you know, I don't know, or I don't care, but I have to do what they tell me. You know, there's an easy way out. They're the expert. There's an easy out there. They're reflecting it.
But on the other hand, you're trying to say, you know, put them back in the driver's seat. Do you agree with that?
Mm-hmm. I think it's, so we want to put them back in the driver's seat. Do you agree with that? My guess is they're probably going to say, yeah, and then I don't know where to go from there. Because really they offered that up, whether it was true or not true or misunderstood or what, then that was offered as a way of saying, I'm good to keep smoking, right? So that's why I think it's reflecting is more effective and efficient, though not the natural first response, I think. But another resistance, yeah.
It could be dangerous for you to stop smoking.
It could be dangerous to your health, in fact, to quit smoking.
Yeah.
So tell me more about that, right? You know, I'm sort of saying this a little bit tongue-in-cheek. It's important that we are empathetic and genuine. So when you say those things, it's important not to be like a, you know, kind of wisecracking, which is easier to do kind of in front of a group of people. But when you're in the moment, you want to be genuine. So who wants to give me another resistance statement? Yep.
You would say... I've been smoking since I was 13 years old. Why would I want to stop now?
I've been smoking since I was 13. Why would I stop now?
Why would you stop now?
Why would you stop now is a good question. Give me a good reflection, too. I've been smoking since I was 13. Why would I quit now?
I would say, so you've been smoking for whatever years.
Mm-hmm. So you could just reflect the word. So you've been smoking for decades.
Whatever.
It opens the discussion. You're not immediately jumping in and taking the bait and saying this is why, but you're reflecting that back and let them pick it up. And you're probably going to get more information about what it is, how involved in their lives it is.
Sounds like you're wondering why you should stop now.
Sounds like you're wondering why you should stop now. Yeah. Tell me more about that. Great. And get more information about that. One more.
Is this a good time to go to the pros and cons matrix?
This could potentially be a good time to do the pros and cons matrix. I think it's important to give some sort of reflection, some sort of acknowledgement of what's been said. Then you can move into, so maybe that's something like, so this is something that's been a big part of your life for a long time. What do you like about it? Move into that. That's great. Yes. Give me one more resistance statement.
You gotta die from something.
You gotta die from something. That's a good one. It's true. You do. What do you say?
So you're saying you're wanting to die from smoking?
So you're saying you're wanting to die from smoking? You make that into a statement. So you want to die from smoking? Maybe. What else could you say?
It's a hard one.
It's kind of a hard one. But I have an advantage because I've heard this one before, right? So, you recognize that smoking can cause your death. Tell me more about that. Right? Good stuff, you guys.
You've had some exposure to resistance statements, which is so shocking. One of my all-time favorites is, oh, you know, my grandparents smoked and ate bacon, and they lived well into their 90s, right? So I'm good. Okay. So then what do you say? What do you say?
Good luck.
Good luck. Yeah. Maybe not. What else? What do you say to that?
So you think there is no reason for concern regarding these habits?
You can see no reason for concern about this. You know, and sometimes, I mean, so we're sort of putting it out there as a resistance statement, but really, in many cases, that's how people see things. I'm fortunate to have this genetic predisposition to be resistant to these terrible things. Okay, well, let's talk more about that. Maybe then what that tells me is that going on about the health consequences of this is not going to get me very far. So how else does smoking affect your life? It costs money to smoke, doesn't it? Maybe not in Missouri as much as other places, but it can get real expensive real quick.
It's about the boyfriend.
About the boyfriend. How does your partner feel about this? How do your kids feel about this? What does this have to do with other aspects of your life? Let's find out more about that. Whenever we get information, I mean, any resistance statement is information. that helps guide where we're going to go. That's why I love resistance. Because again, this is our opportunity to bring something brand new to the table. In my experience, it's difficult for folks who see patients in a clinic setting every 10, 15 minutes and have multiple health problems to talk about to not jump on these behaviors with a quick, you know you shouldn't do that, or here are the reasons why you shouldn't do that, and so on. We have something else totally different to offer. We don't have to respond with an argument or a piece of education to these resistance statements. We can roll with them. And when we do that, we get people thinking. When we confront resistance, we give people a reason to shut down. We're not going to give people anything to push against. Right? If I push against you and you push back, I get to keep pushing. But if you step out of the way, I'm just left with me. That's where we want them.
I think another important thing is to not feel like you have to get them to action that day.
Yes. Remember, much of effective and brief MI is about doing exactly what the system doesn't want you to do. Slow down. It's not my job to make you do anything. It's also important that I recognize change is a process, and often a slow one. So let's take it. Let's accept that reality and slow down. And that is actually more efficient. All right, so I think what we'll do next is, first of all, have any questions or comments or thoughts from the part that we've just kind of gone over? People want to talk about or questions to ask? Okay? So what I want to do is play a clip. So this is a clip of an encounter in a healthcare setting that's less than 8 minutes long, addressing cholesterol with a patient using an MI style. So what I'd like you to do is watch and pay attention to those aspects of MI that you notice, and we'll talk about what you see here. So I'm going to get it started, and tell me if you have any trouble hearing it or if it's too loud.
Following vignette, a woman with hypertension and high cholesterol discusses her diet and exercise within the context of a medical consultation.
So Sue, I just got back the results from the rapid test, and it showed that you do not have strep, which is good.
I am so grateful for that.
Yeah.
I've been around my grandson, and I was so worried, you know, if I had strep, I was so worried I would give it to him. And so that's very good news.
So probably what it is, it's a virus, which might take a little time just to get out of your system. So a couple things you can do, just try to get maybe a little more rest, drink plenty of fluids. If you need to take some lozenges to soothe your throat, those things might be helpful.
Okay, and it's nothing else bad. It's probably just a virus.
Probably not. We'll send out for the full report, but it's looking pretty much like it's not.
Okay, bad. Well, that just sounds great.
Good. Thank you. So, and if you're not feeling better in a couple of days, feel free to give me a call. We can certainly reevaluate.
Okay. All right.
But if it's all right with you, I'd like to just follow up on our visit from last time when we talked. We did some blood work, and we talked a little bit about your cholesterol and your blood pressure being a little higher than we would like.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering if you've given some thought to that and where you are.
Well, I have. I did look at the brochures you gave me, and but I was wondering, could this just be a fluke, this blood test, that maybe it really isn't true?
That maybe it's not really higher.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's possible,
yeah.
But it's likely that it is elevated for some reason. And
it's kind of been creeping up, but mm-hmm. Now it's quite a bit higher than it was the last time.
That's right. So we've noticed a trend of it increasing over time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I did read the brochures that you gave me, and I know that I need to change my eating habits if I'm going to try to get my blood pressure and cholesterol down. But I just hate that because we've just moved back to New Mexico, and I've missed the food here so much. We moved back about a year ago. You know, I think I told you we were in Texas, and I missed the green chili enchiladas and the burritos and the... you know, all the wonderful mindful food, and so and my husband too, and we eat out a lot, and so it's really hard to follow the healthy eating plans.
So it's been hard to reduce your favorite foods.
It's been very hard, and my husband and I have both struggled with our weight over the years. I mean, I know in my mind what I should be eating and what I shouldn't be eating, and I know about portion control and all that business, but I haven't been practicing it, as you can tell.
Okay.
But if this is for real, I mean, if I really am in danger, I will take it more seriously and try and, you know, eat a little bit more healthy and give up some of the cheese and the delicious food that I love.
Okay. Yeah. So it's not like you know how to eat healthy.
I do know how to eat healthy. Yes, I do. Both my husband and I do. He is on medication, which you've told me would be my next step if I don't do something.
That's right. So you're kind of at a golden opportunity here, and things can either go one of two ways. If you continue as you are, there's a good likelihood that your blood pressure and cholesterol are going to continue to rise, yeah, at which point we might need to talk about medication.
Right.
So I don't know how you feel about that.
I do not feel good about that at all. My husband takes 9 pills a day, and, you know, I'm not sure that it's even still controlling his blood pressure and his cholesterol. And, I mean, I don't want to be in that position. So
taking pills isn't something you want to see?
No, I do not want to do that, no. I'm thinking even if we go out 2 or 3 times a week, you know, I could eat a few tortilla chips and a little bit of salsa and then maybe have a salad just to at least get the flavor of the chili.
Okay, so it sounds like you know that, yeah, you can go out to eat and still make healthy choices.
I think I can, and maybe my husband would even follow my lead a little bit. I mean, maybe I would help him a little bit too, which would be an added bonus.
So that might benefit both of you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And make it easier for you to follow as well.
Exactly. Yeah. If we could both kind of be in partnership. And I know he worries about me too. He doesn't want me to be on medication either. So maybe we can help each other.
Mm-hmm. So he might be motivated to work with you on this.
I think so.
Yeah.
I do. And I'm willing to try it, and we'll just see if it doesn't make a difference.
Okay. So it sounds, yeah, like you're ready to make some of those changes.
Yes.
Okay.
I am.
Mm-hmm.
Reluctantly, but I am.
But it's important to you.
It's very important to me, yeah. I want to be around. I want to be healthy for my grandchildren and my children.
Mm-hmm.
And we have a lot of fun, and, you know, I don't want my health to interfere with that.
Okay. So you have a lot of important reasons for wanting to be healthy.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, I do.
So good. So we talked a little bit about your eating habits, and it sounds like you know some things that you can do to get started with that.
Yes.
And I'm wondering where you're at with your exercise.
But exercise is such a bad word for me. I mean, I hate going to the gym. I hate working out. I hate sweating. I just, you know, would rather be carried everywhere. But I know that's not going to happen. But I'll tell you what I have been doing since I read your brochures, and that is when I go to the store, instead of parking the close spot, I park far out in the parking lot. Not only does my car not get dinged, but I get a few more steps in, and I figure that certainly can't hurt me. It doesn't seem like a lot, but it adds up because I do a lot of shopping. So
it sounds like you're already doing more.
I'm doing that. Yes, and it just, you know, it's not that much, but it's a little bit. And I also take stairs if it's only a couple of floors. Rather than take the elevator, I've been taking the stairs.
Mm-hmm. So you're finding ways of building exercise into your day.
Yeah, and that I don't mind.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to go sweat for an hour and, you know, go to the gym where all these young, beautiful women are working out. I don't want to do that, but I don't mind parking and walking stairs.
Okay. Well, the important thing to recognize is that exercise doesn't have to be going to a gym and sweating. You can walk more, you can take the stairs, you can do more activity in your day to build in lifestyle activity in. And the more you do, the more it can make a difference.
So that does help. That makes a difference.
It can add up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, do you think then that we could test my blood again and see if what I'm doing is making a difference?
Absolutely. Yeah, and that's a really good idea. So what we could do is we could set up another appointment in about 3 months.
Okay.
And if you want to focus on your eating and trying to get more of your daily activity in, you can come back in about 3 months and we'll retest and we'll see how you're doing.
Okay.
And then we'll go
ahead. I would like that.
Okay, very good.
All right, well, thank you so much.
Okay, glad you came in today.
Me too. Bye-bye.
Bye. In In the previous vignette, the provider demonstrates several important skills and principles of motivational interviewing. First, the provider supports self-efficacy by emphasizing the impact that the patient has on the direction of treatment. The provider also helps the patient to identify her own solutions, solutions that may work in the context of her life. The provider also elicits change talk by helping the client to identify and explore her own reasons for wanting to change.
What else did you notice about that? Oh, wait, we're not doing this. Sorry. I'm sorry. Didn't mean to. All right, I'm closing it up. I think we're done with this.
So, what did you notice about that vignette?
Other than that was a really great patient, right?
Yeah.
Lots of reflections, especially initially.
Lots of reflections, especially early on. Yep.
Notice the provider let the patient wrap it up.
Yeah.
Like the provider didn't have to give the final word. Like, here's what we've decided today. She just got quiet and let the patient summarize.
Right. The provider didn't do all the talking. The provider did not a lot of the talking. And sometimes I think that's part of what makes it hard for us to do reflections is I think sometimes there's an underlying fear that once the patient gets going, they're going to go, right? And so we want to kind of take control. Sometimes that happens. And so what we find is that when we let the patient do more of the talking, sometimes really good things happen. We can direct that by the nature of our reflections. We reflect the things we want to hear more about. So we can still guide the conversation without doing all the talking. Great. Anything else that you noticed? Yeah.
Yeah, summarized what the patient was saying about her husband being a support and, you know, she didn't want to get on the medicine, she wasn't faced with change her eating. She just summarized what she had already stated.
Yeah, she summarized what you're pointing out, and she summarized a lot of the change talks that the patient had provided. Why her husband was on board and not wanting to take medications, exactly. Summarizing is a great way of reflecting.
And she got more positive, even her facial expression, right when the change talk hit. She was collecting her change and she was getting
it. Yeah, absolutely. You notice the affect changes. It gets a little bit brighter the more the change talk happens and gets collected. You bet. So I always find in these kind of vignettes, my mind goes to, well, it's much harder than that in my clinic or, you know, that, these are all the reasons why that's different from the things that I do or why that's easier. So what I'd like to do for the rest of our time today is do some practicing. Why don't we practice what this is like with real or simulated based on real encounters? So if it's okay, what I'd like to do is maybe have somebody come up and we'll practice a session or practice a brief encounter. So if anybody has a particular patient or encounter that they've or person that they've been working with that they'd like to come up and role play the patient, we'll do a practice here and we'll talk about things. Sound reasonable? Anybody want to come be a patient? Yeah, come on up. I'm going to give you a microphone. It'll be slightly unnatural. Yes. Do the standing and I go from there?
Yep.
All right, so what we'll do is kind of if you could just give a brief setup for what our encounter is and we'll go from there.
This is a an attendant referral for treatment for alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And the person is resistant to that idea for couple of reasons. One, he feels like he has responsibility for a grandson that he helps to take care of. He is, and just recently lost his wife to death and is really going through some grief and feels connected to the clinic, but's afraid to get referred, doesn't want to be referred out, at least not initially.
Okay. Can everybody hear?
I'm going to turn
it
up a little bit.
Okay. Sometimes you have to kind of hold it.
You have to really love
this. Yeah, you have to really own it. Okay, so
So the story is, so I'm a health consultant then. Mm-hmm. You're the patient who's been referred for alcoholism. This is somebody who is resistant to the idea of treatment.
Yes.
Is responsible for a grandson, has lost a wife recently to death, feels connected to the clinic, but not really invested or interested at this point in going elsewhere for what I'm assuming we're thinking about is inpatient treatment. Or
yes, at minimum, assess
and outpatient. Okay. Give me a first name.
Bob.
Bob, all right. So Bob, thanks for coming in and being willing to talk with me today. I know that Dr. Horwitz referred you over, and just wanted to kind of start with, how are you feeling about being here today?
Well, it's fine being here, right? You know, it's this place, folks really understand where I'm coming from, and when my wife died, everybody was just really supportive and really helpful. They were here for me.
You got a lot of good relationships established here.
Yeah.
Feeling cared for.
Yeah.
And so your doctor had asked you to come and talk to me a little bit today about your drinking. So I wonder if you could tell me a little bit about your drinking.
Well, I really had been doing really well for a long time. Say I've been sober for quite a while, but after my wife died, my friends have been coming around, and I don't have any money right now. My income's basically been wiped out, but I got these buddies who will just come around, and they want me to, come, and they'll buy me all the liquor that I can drink. It's been kind of tough.
I'm really sorry to hear about your wife. It sounds like things have been going pretty well for you for a period of time, and, that's not always easy to do.
Yeah, she's the only one that ever really understood me totally.
It's a big loss. It's changed your life. So you have some friends who are supportive, and that's also contributed to more drinking. You've described that as being really tough.
Yeah, really, I've known them all my life. They're kind of like family, when I was sober, I really didn't see much of them. But it didn't really make much difference because my wife was around and us spending more time with my grandson and helping out with his care, and so I didn't really miss it that much. But now I'd just be sitting all day at the house, and these guys would come over and say, "Hey, well, let's get you out of the house," and then that just leads to drinking.
So having friendships and supportive relationships is really important. And you have a lot of responsibilities at home.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, because the next generation, they just really don't know what's going on in terms of taking care of this kid. This kid needs me.
Mm-hmm. He's very important to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
So on the one hand, it sounds like your grandson is very important to you, and this relationship with these friends is causing drinking that you don't feel 100% comfortable with.
No. I know it's not good. I know it's something that I've got to address. I've got to change because I don't feel good either when I drink. I mean, I can feel it. I'm not well.
You don't want to continue this way.
No, I really don't.
You talk about wanting to change. Can you tell me more about what that looks like?
Well, I've done it before. I've just got to figure out how can I, do it,
You've been successful. You've done this.
Yeah.
And now it's a matter of figuring a way forward to get to that good place again.
Absolutely.
And so your doctor had sent you to talk to me to talk maybe a little bit more about what that plan might look like.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts about that?
Well, the thing that keeps staring me in the face all the time is my wife not being here anymore. And I think I really need to talk about that. I need to talk to somebody about that. That's why I want to talk to you about that.
So I hear you saying, and I appreciate you sharing that with me, and I'm hearing you say that you've been successful in quitting drinking before, and that felt good. And now part of what's getting in the way is, how are you feeling about losing your wife? That's a real loss.
It's leaves me speechless, period.
Part of the way forward is working.
This is when he just cries.
Yeah. Part of the way forward to quitting the drinking is really about dealing with this loss and how you're feeling about that. Would it be okay if we scheduled some sessions to talk through that?
Yeah.
Great. That'd
be good.
What do people, we'll just go ahead and stop right there for a second. So what do people notice about that encounter? Either from the patient perspective, from the provider perspective, what do you observe?
It was like what? He did the leading.
He did a lot of the leading. Right. He did a lot of the talking.
Just by your reflection, he was able to identify the barrier to this.
So through that context, he was able to identify the barrier to sobriety, right? So what we found was, by letting him do the talking, we find that really maybe where we need to be focusing, at least in conjunction with the drinking, is with the grief. It's not just about the drinking, it's about the grief. What else? Yep.
He indicated a reason too, but by his grandchild.
Mm-hmm.
That was affecting the value system. You know,
right.
Being a father, a grandfather.
We really got an insight into what he values. He values being a positive person in the life of his grandson, taking care of him and imparting things that this generation is sorely lacking in his view, right? That's huge. That's very important. That is something we can work with. How's the drinking affect his ability to be a good grandparent? I got my own ideas about that, but it doesn't matter. How does he see that? That's where we would go. Questions about that? Places that could have gone differently? There's 1,000 directions that this could go. Other thoughts? Yep.
John, what's your role's name? I forget.
Bob
mentioned that he had been successful before.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that would have been a good follow-up. What did you do?
Mm-hmm.
That worked great in the past.
Absolutely. He's done this before. So we're going to want more information about how did that work before? What kinds of tools did he use then that he still has now and can use now? Or could be changed or adapted to now? Yes?
He could have criticized him for hanging out with his friend, being that they are influencing him to drink. But you did go there. You just reflected that to basically what was more important to him.
Right. There's a pretty obvious sort of barrier that jumps up right there, which is the friend. So my mind is thinking, we got to deal with that. We got to address that, right? But rather than saying that, just sort of reflect back what he said about it, right? Because people don't really like it when we tell them who their friends can be.
Right.
Right? Yeah. Good. Excellent. Are you ready to practice? Yes? All right, Phil. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Here's what I want to do at this point. So this is all, in my mind, motivational interviewing is extremely simple conceptually, right? These are not overly involved concepts. It's very straightforward. Treat people like they're autonomous humans. Be nice. Be empathic, right? Listen. Let them talk. So let's practice that, because in practice, it's much more difficult to do. So what I want you to do is to get into groups of, say, 3 or 4, based on kind of where you're at. One of you is going to role play a patient, okay? One of you is going to start as the therapist or the health consultant, health coach. It's going to be yourself, okay? And you're going to have an encounter where you try to use these skills that we've talked about, starting with open questions, reflecting, rolling with resistance, affirming, summarizing, okay? Collecting change talk. The others of you are going to observe, but you can tag in and tag out, take timeouts, and, you know, here's where I want to ask a question, or someone help me figure out where to go from here. I want you to just take about 10, 10 minutes or so to do this, okay? Then I'm going to float around and kind of be around, and you can ask me questions, or I'll just eavesdrop, which I'm happy to do. And then we're going to come back together, and we're going to talk about what went well and what didn't go well, okay? Everybody good with what we're doing? If you get to a point you're encountering that 10 minutes where you're done, you can switch roles. So, go ahead. In those encounters, what did you notice? Either as an observer, or as the provider, or as the patient? Yes?
There were smiles on both sides.
There were smiles on both sides. How often does that happen? Huh? What else? I'm curious, let's start with what went well. Then we'll get into the really good stuff.
I noticed when the provider was nodding, then the patient started nodding along with
one of those sort of nonverbal tricks that we use, maybe. No. But really, the nodding means I'm hearing you, I get it, I'm with you. And that brings a positive response from the patient. Absolutely. Yes.
As the provider, it felt like it took some of the pressure off because I wasn't trying to get her to do something.
Takes the pressure off as a provider. I don't have to get you to do anything. Exactly. Good. What else went well?
I heard a lot of support from the therapist that was very genuine and specific. It wasn't just this, oh, you're doing good, you know, like this generic praise. It was genuine, it was specific to what he was hearing and reflecting.
There was genuine, specific support given. Not just, you're doing well, that's great, but this is what's going well, this is what I'm hearing. Genuine empathy and support. Absolutely, specific.
I wanted to verify with my patient why they thought they received me. Like the provider had referred them for something, but I want to make sure that you're on the same level of what we're wanting to work on.
Right. Great place to start is tell me why you're here today. Right? Because sometimes you have to go back and look at your sheet and say, is this really the person I'm supposed to be seeing? Because this isn't what I thought they were here for. That's a great thing. That's a great place to start. You get a really good sense of the patient's perspective, and that's what MI is all about. You bet. Bring it back to the basics. Anything else go well? What didn't go well? Yes.
A really tough situation that you don't have the answers for.
A really tough situation that you don't have the answers for.
Or that you don't know what to do.
You want to talk about that? You want to share what that experience was?
Yeah. Diabetic patient.
You want to come up? Or you want me to bring the microphone? Let me bring the microphone to you. Do my Ricky Lick. Okay. Yes.
Actually a diabetic patient that her and her husband were living with some family members who were kicked out of the house. Uh-huh. They are living in a tent in their backyard. Mm-hmm. They only have so much food stamps. Mm-hmm. They have no way to keep the insulin cold. Mm-hmm. A1C, of course, is one of them because they're eating carbs because that's what's cheap and it doesn't go bad. So, you know, talk about wise choices as the best they can do, and the best way to try to keep the insulin cold, and what they can, you know, what they can do for the future and the resources that are out there. So,
yeah.
You don't have all, you know, you don't have the good answers for them, but.
People get a good handle on that? What that was? Diabetic couple? Homeless, essentially, no way to keep insulin cold, no real resources. So it's hard because there's no good solution, right? What do people think about that? Yes?
So sometimes people don't know what, they say they can't afford things that are healthy, but So maybe they don't know. So like a can of tuna is how much, but it has better protein in it. So, you know, sometimes it's talking about meals and food and what your resources can look like with $200 a month on food stamps. How can we get the healthy things you need within that $200, and what kind of things do you really buy?
So some of it could be clarifying perceptions of resources, and are there things that could be purchased that are healthier choices on a limited resource? What else do people think?
Two things came up, and they might sound contradictory, but starting where the patient is, if that patient's truly homeless, then maybe we need to work with them or refer them to someone that can help them with that, but also that wanting to fix it, wanting to fix a piece of hearing someone's story, and our heart breaks for them, and it's so easy to get pulled down with that sympathy instead of empathy and go into this despair mode with them. But looking at how can we stay like grounded and help them kind of come up with their own solutions, but maybe that session would need to be oriented more towards, you know, the hierarchy of needs, really.
Mm-hmm. Right, so it is tempting or can be easy to, number one, feel like I have to solve this and I don't know what the answer is, and now I'm feeling helpless, and now we're all kind of feeling helpless and stuck. And so really it's coming back to that MI perspective, which is I don't have to have the solutions. That's a tough situation, and I don't have the ability to solve that problem. But I do have the ability to be empathetic for that person, and I do have the ability to help them sort through some of the options. And they may not be the ideal options, but thinking about things in a different way, thinking about how can you use the resources, the very limited resources that you do have, in a better way. But I can empathize, not sympathize, as Toby said. What else? Yes?
Yeah, again, along those lines of looking at what's a chewable problem that you want to address, that you want to go ahead and take, that you have a possibility of success, like somebody, is there someone trying to find a place to put your insulin?
Yeah.
Is there something that you're or do you think looking for a place to live is more important, or do you think looking for food is more important? Where do you start? Where do you want to start?
Where do you start? Yes, right. Where do you want to start with this? How can I help you work through this? Not how am I going to solve this, because I don't know how to solve it. I don't know how to solve that. But I know how to help you work through it. Make sense? I mean, I think that really touches on that core piece of it, which is that my role is fixer, solution finder. And it's not from an MI perspective. But it's a tough one. There's no question about that. Yep.
We print out the cards in our office to give to our clients that are facing multiple issues, like homeless, no money for medications, this type of thing. And it's just a little card with our business logo on the front and our phone numbers. And then on the back, we have a list of, like, from the homeless shelter, food bags, things like that. But we give that card to the client and say, contact these places.
Providing community resources
for folks.
They may
be able to help you. And then that helps us to focus on the problem at hand, what we need to do.
I think you're right. So there are a number of ways to get people in contact with resources. And from an MI perspective, we start with what? What is the core foundation of MI? We want to start with empathy. Not sympathy, empathy. That's a lousy situation to be in. You know? I can empathize with that. I can empathize with some of that. You know? So that's where we start. And respecting the patient's autonomy. Not the patient as helpless victim, but a patient who is autonomous, that could use help. And if they want that help, then I can be helpful, but I will not fix for. Because that's not helpful. But I can help guide through the process. That makes sense. There's the distinction. What else did people notice about these practice scenarios? What was tough or what was challenging?
Staying patient.
Okay, staying patient. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, this was an addiction example where the person was, you could see the dopamine firing in her brain as she was talking about the addiction and the total delusional thoughts about how that was going to fix everything. It was a gambling example of how making that big win was going to solve all of the problems, even though she was in bankruptcy and gone through divorce and had all the negative consequences occurred. And so she was totally pre-contemplative and really just trying to sit back enough to just to create a little bit of movement towards contemplation.
How do you do that?
I just kept reflecting when she would give me a little space about some of the negative consequences and having her describe what happened, you know, how did you get to that point, and tell me about your the bankruptcy, and then tell me about, and then she let out that she worked three jobs. So I said, okay, so when you worked three jobs that week, the last time you went to the boat, you worked three jobs the week before, what happened to your money? How did that go with going to boats? And tell me about your boat experience.
Right.
And I could see in her facial expression that created a little bit of
a little bit of, I mean, what that was like from your perspective as a patient.
Well, trying to create the dissonance, trying to help me see that, you know, this isn't really all that fun. But I kept telling him, oh, but it's so much fun, and if I could just get that big win, it would make it all right. And he didn't want to insult me.
Uh-huh.
He didn't want to, you know, start an argument with me, but he kept trying to bring it back to the problems that were being created from the gambling and from losing everything and blaming everybody else and everything else.
Yeah, so through strategic reflections, getting you to recognize your words were saying those things.
Back in my mind, I said, okay, this is a 10 session.
Right. Yeah.
So one thing that may be difficult is making sure that you bring up challenges your patient might face, because you don't want them to have not be successful and then say, well, this didn't work, so
yeah.
I'm not going to do anything. So we talked about, like, this was a person who was an alcoholic and was trying to cut down on their drinking, and you know, they want to go from day to day to nothing, and the realist, that's not going to be instant to happen.
Right.
So what if you have that fear, then what's going to happen? So they can plan ahead for events that occur.
Right, so when it comes time to make a plan for change, we want to do that in a way that we don't set people up for failure. We want to be very thoughtful about that. We didn't talk a whole lot about that piece of things today, but that's absolutely right. We don't want to start with an overly ambitious plan or a plan that doesn't account for possible roadblocks or challenges. That is very important, absolutely. You know, and I think that when you can use reflections to sort of help the patient clarify the ambivalence, right? Clarify the challenges. When you reflect, you're just showing them or letting them hear their own challenges, right? Letting them hear their own roadblocks and reflecting those back. It's much more powerful when I generate that stuff myself and then have to hear it than if somebody else tells it to me. If somebody else tells it to me, it's easy for me to block that out. It's something else when I know it's coming out of my own mouth. Part of what allows us to do the things that we do that aren't so great for us is that we don't think about it, okay? So I don't know anybody who smokes, who every time they smoke, is thinking about what's going on with their heart, thinking about what's going on with their lungs, and all the negative health effects, right? There's an awareness of that, but we're able to keep doing the things that we do by not staying there in that headspace, right? When I am at Sonic, I am not thinking about what is going on in my arteries. You don't want it, I know it, but I'm not thinking about it. That's what lets me keep doing it, right? Other challenges, issues that came up in these practice sessions? Areas where you feel like more clarification would be helpful? Places where you think that MI maybe isn't appropriate?
You know, I think it was important to show all the problems that came into the session in the beginning. I said this is going to be a 10-session, you know, person, because there's so much.
Yeah. So laying it all out there before you figure out, pick an early focus on where you're going to go. Let's get a broad picture first. And that is part of that MI approach. We talked about sort of traps to avoid, and one that I didn't really spend time on was premature focus. Right? Let's put it all out on the table before we figure out where we're going to go. But if you say something that triggers something in me and we jump down that path, then we forget about the role that a boyfriend plays in smoking, right, for instance. Yep?
I know you asked about when MI may not be appropriate, and she was really not. She turned around very easy. She's a good patient. But she was taking Xanax from a friend, and that was the only thing that worked. So I spend a lot of time with people that either inadvertently are seeking benzos because they've been exposed, or they're just drug seeking. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I do kind of struggle with that sometimes between do I use MI and try to be, you know, helpful to these folks, or is it just do I need to work with, you know, clarifying boundaries and making it clear that.
Yeah.
And that's a real challenge for me, I'm sure, probably, I guess.
Right. So the issue is sort of people seeking benzos or other medications. When do we work with MI and when do we, you know?
Yeah, it's hard because you want to be a professional and helpful to them, but then other times you know, you do it several times a day and it's kind of hard to stay in that.
Yeah. It is important to note that MI is not always appropriate. It's not for every situation. It's not for every patient. It's not for every encounter, for sure. And sometimes, you can do other things in an MI consistent way. You can set boundaries and say this is acceptable and this is not acceptable, but do that in a way that's empathetic, respects that person's, you know, decision to comply with those guidelines or not, but just sort of stating what the consequences are. Getting a sense of what they think are the pros and the cons, but being very clear about this is what's going to happen here and this is what's not. Absolutely. Go ahead.
Yeah, and again, you want to be, you know, you don't want to be harsh.
Right. You can do all that stuff, even when you're feeling really frustrated, in an empathetic way, for sure. It is hard. It is frustrating.
And that's kind of how I try to approach it, but sometimes I do feel like maybe I'm getting jaded, and you just have to approach it more. It's like, here's the boundaries, these are the rules.
And sometimes... Yeah, these are the boundaries. Would it be okay if I shared with you, or I need to share with you what these boundaries are? What do you make of that? Sort of gauge, reflect, you know, gauge where they're at with it.
Because the doctors normally just kind of, and I don't know for anybody else, but they just kind of want me to be the enforcer. I'm like, go tell them I'm not going to stay.
Yeah.
You know, who am I working for? Uh-huh. You kind of have dual relationships there. It's very interesting.
One of the things I talk about how difficult it is now for doctors with benzodiazepines and pain medicine because they're tracking a lot of that. They're having repercussions about going to get prescribed for long term. And I'll do a little education spiel about just kind of the outside world pressures against them prescribing those. And a little bit about why it is.
But my intervention normally turns more into a lecture of why you don't, and then sometimes I feel like maybe I'm just an opportunity to be helpful for someone.
I think
it's just a real hard balance.
It is a hard balance, there's no question about it. And sometimes time or the situation dictates that your role is to just provide the information. and say, this is the way that it's going to be. This provider is not prescribing it. If you'd like to know the reasons why, would it be okay if I shared them with you? And they're free to want to hear that or not, but you can be clear on this is what will and won't happen. But sometimes it is an opportunity to, you know, if people are interested in hearing more, to give them that information. But I think whenever you are in a position to provide information, it's always a great place to start by saying, what's your understanding of why this doctor isn't prescribing for you? Because sometimes people get it, but whatever, or they just don't get it. And so it could be about education, or it could be about helping them come to a shared understanding in some way. So that, I think, is always a great place to start. When you want to give information, first ask what they know about it.
Sometimes you just, if you frame it as a risk, mm-hmm. and what those risks are, and that's why the doctor is concerned
right.
about you, and, you know, go through that when you can elicit and provide that information.
Right, so
frame it, what the risks are.
Framing that conversation in terms of risks. Being, you know, specific about what the risks are to the patient, but we have to validate, you know, oftentimes, be clear. I mean, there's a risk for the physician, and that's a big part of this too, right? People have licenses on the line, and there's a lot of issues that go into there. So being honest about both sides of the equation, but also really highlighting the risk to that patient. So you've been waiting, sorry.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, as a behavioral health consultant, no few situations are the same. Get called in on or pulled in on many different things, including if a patient they may be in an acute crisis state,
mm-hmm.
which at that time, then being more directive seems like the way to go anyway, because they're not able to process much of anything in that state of mind.
Right. Taking your patient where they're at. So if it's an acute crisis situation, probably much more directive and less eliciting. Whereas if they're in a different or a place where they're maybe better able to hear what it is that you have to say, then your approach differs. You're right, it's not a one-size-fits-all. And there are a lot of situations where it's just not appropriate. Certainly if somebody has a risk to sell for others, not the time to really kind of get into pros and cons and things like that. That's your role, is to be directive, is to be solution-focused and helping with that process. So there are certainly situations where it isn't appropriate. And if somebody's ready to change, there's no need to continue to elicit motivation. When somebody's ready to make the change, then our role is to help work out a plan that is set someone up for to increase likelihood of success versus failure. Is there something else over here?
Well, I just, our planning is that we know narcotics. And we do have people come in and, you know, they give you a story. You don't know if it's true or not, but they've been in pain because of a prior accident. And so if you can offer them an alternative, our doctor does not give that, but she would be glad to refer you to pain management. Mm-hmm. So you're not, if they truly are in pain, you're not leaving them with nothing. But then if you go on, get them referred to a specialist, that's up to them whether they choose then to pursue it.
Right, so even if the bottom line is that the patient's not going to get what they want, whether that's benzos, narcotics, whatever the case may be, validating or empathizing with where they're at, so recognizing that this is maybe, you know, taking for granted that this is real pain. This is not somebody who's just seeking drugs, but having empathy for that person and offering alternative solutions. You know, I think the point is the MI approach respects patient autonomy. People are free to feel what they want to feel about it. People don't have to like having their Xanax taken away. Remember, Xanax works. Alcohol works. Smoking works. And I think that, you know, in many clinics, in our clinic as well, there tends to be this, oh, chronic pain. Right? I know this is going to go. Somebody get the narcotics contract ready. You know, so there's this whole, like, we're going to go fight this battle. But people use these things for very good reasons. For very good reasons. So MI says, bring it right back to, this is another human being who's a rational human being who does things for rational reasons. It's my job, oftentimes, to figure out what those reasons are. What's working well for you about the Xanax? Is there anything about it that you don't like? For instance, having to come and fight for it every time. Right? That's not fun. Or having to switch doctors so you get somebody to get it for you. So taking it from that perspective, what is it about this? What's this like for you as a patient? Not Dr. So-and-so sent me in to tell you the story. What's your story? Tell me. That's what MI tells us to do. And then I think we find that people are more likely to be receptive to what we have to say. Not guaranteed, but increased likelihood. Right? The other thing I think is important to take away from these discussions is that change is not a one and done thing. It's unreasonable, I think, to expect that in a 5 or 10 minute encounter, even in a half an hour encounter, that we're going to get somebody to realize, oh my goodness, this has been a terrible choice, lifestyle choice I've been making. I want to change it. Let's figure this out. How am I going to change it? And yet I think somewhere implicitly we anticipate, we expect that's how it's supposed to go. Right? You're in my office, I will prescribe the solution, and we'll go.
Ta-da.
Right, ta-da! I'm not that good. And I have 30 minutes or an hour, and I'm not that good. So change is slow. Raising the issue, that's an intervention. That's how you do MI in a brief setting. You talk about it. You ask a patient to share their perspective about what it is that they're doing, the pros and the cons. That's an intervention. That allows the space for that person to think about it. And it's harder to do something that's not good for us when we're thinking about it. It's easier to do that when we just don't think about it. But that's an intervention, and that doesn't take but a few minutes. And you may not see the change that happens, and most often, you will not see the change. And that is the downside of what we do. But that doesn't mean we're not being effective every day.
I was just going to say, you know, those pros of why they do what they do are really important. So when they start making that change, go back and look at that pros list. They smoke because they're bored. What else can you do when you're bored? They smoke because they're stressed. How else can you reduce stress? And help them come up with other ways that they can get those same benefits without doing what they're doing that's causing them those cons.
Right. When you know what those pros are, the reasons people do what they do, when it comes time to make a plan, you can go back and find other ways to meet those needs. Right. Absolutely.
Especially other ways that they already use.
Especially other ways that they already use. You bet. Mm-hmm. So, what is it about going to Sonic? It's kind of nice to go take a break, middle of the day, just me, in my car, my own food, nobody's bothering me.
Nobody's asking me for anything.
It's just me. Somebody comes and gives me something that I like, that's nice. All those things are reasons that I do that, right? And those are valid reasons. Those are rational reasons. So it's kind of a humorous example, but there isn't anything that any of us do that we might, all things being equal, change, that we don't do for very good reasons. Same thing goes for our patients who are engaging in what we think are not good behaviors. Smoking works, drinking works, drugs work. That doesn't mean they're the right choices or healthy choices. But people do these things for rational and valid reasons. MI says, let's just stop and recognize that, for starters. Other thoughts or reactions or questions? I would encourage each of you to really practice reflecting. I think if you can really get reflections to be your natural approach, you're really going far with MI. Just reflect what you hear. It really makes you think about things differently. It makes you listen. It makes you work with the patient driving the bus and being the driver's ed teacher, which is really scary at first, right? Kind of. But then you really start to embrace your role as guide, not fixer, not expert, but guide in the journey that the patient is taking. Practice reflecting. That's one skill I think that you can really work on. We can all work on developing better. Other questions or thoughts?
Okay. Why don't we go ahead and call it good then? Thanks, everybody.